Welcome to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. Here's your host, Dr. Frank Rossi.
Welcome to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi, Cornell University and the TurfNet Radio Network. Another episode in front of us, this time with Professor Dr. Joe Roberts in the Department of Plant Science and Landscape Architecture at the University of Maryland. Joe just joined the University of Maryland in the last few years because I know Joe's predecessor fairly well, Dr. Peter Noden, who's now retired and still working in the area. And I know Peter from his graduate school days at the University of Rhode Island when he studied under Noel Jackson. So I knew Pete a long time. Glad to see the position was continued. There's another connection at Maryland, Joe, that I have with Mark Carroll. Mark was a graduate student here at Cornell University when I was on the when I was a graduate student here back in the late 1980s. And joining me today is Professor Joe Roberts, and we're going to wander through Joe's career a little bit, a young scientist in the turfgrass field that's working on some enormously progressive research, and Joe's bringing it over with his microbiological expertise into the turf world. So, Joe, without any further ado, we're going to wander through a couple of minutes of your career, and then I want to talk a little bit about your work with anthracnose, and then bacterial elation and how I think those things are connected in some way. And then I want to talk about your microbiome work when we can maybe talk about Dan Danelli in our last podcast here on Frankly Speaking. So, Joe, welcome to the program. Where were you a pre-med major with a biology and chemistry concentration?
All right. Well, thanks so much for having me on today. I do appreciate the opportunity. And so my background's kind of interesting in terms of where I started. I actually did my undergraduate degree at NC State, and I originally went into college as a pre-medical major. I was interested in med school, and coming from a small town in North Carolina, really didn't know about, you know, a lot of these positions in agriculture, let alone turfgrass science, and came across a research opportunity working with Dr. Jim Kearns and Lane Treadway during my time at NC State. And it's funny, actually, that position was advertised in my biochemistry class, and my girlfriend at the time and now wife actually encouraged me to apply. So I applied for the position, and I started doing some work with them. I actually did kind of a characterization of turbularia on Zoysia as a honors project to finish up my undergraduate degree. And then Lane got me connected with Bruce Clark at Rutgers University, and I interviewed with Bruce and Jim Murphy and went up there shortly after finishing my undergraduate degree to work on my master's.
Okay, and so that brought you to Rutgers University and our mutual pal, Rich Buckley, the degenerate Yankee fan and deadhead who runs the diagnostic services there at Rutgers University, who speaks very highly of you, which, of course, Joe, immediately puts you in good stead with me, pal. So now you're at Rutgers, and you're doing anthracnose work, right? Bruce and Jim had this massive effort that they were doing: growth regulators, nitrogen fertilizers, irrigation, top dressing, traffic, you know, you name it. They were potassium with Chaz later on, right? All these things. And I see from the publication list you were doing irrigation. I also see your name on the top dressing publication. So you were there for the period of time. Just talk for a little bit about what you did when you were at Rutgers in the anthracnose program.
Yeah, so I kind of came into that program sort of the beginning middle stages when they really got that project going and really, like you said, I mean, really trying to pick apart every cultural management practice that's related to that particular disease. You know, just the work that's come out of there, you know, during my time and even since I've been gone, really understanding the impact of cultural management and a particular disease is just phenomenal. Yeah. So my work, actually, I kind of came into work specifically to work on irrigation and lightweight rolling. So, you know, kind of coming into that program, there was kind of an irrigation project that was outlined, and we started looking at daily ET replacement And you know well as I do, you know, poa definitely requires some daily watering in the heat of the summer. And we were looking at replacement of daily ET, and that was kind of the main project that I had come into. And then we started some work looking at lightweight rolling and mowing effects. And, you know, one of the things that we found, particularly with the ET, is that, you know, basically over and under watering of annual bluegrass can stimulate anthracnose. Whereas, you know, kind of keeping it in the 60 to 80% ET replacement on a daily plan is definitely the way to go from a quality.
And you know what's funny, Joe? Let me interrupt you, which you know I do like crazy. If you listen to the program, all the listeners know Frank doesn't let anybody talk. He's going to get his 2 cents in. I wonder if did that work today, Joe, would you do it with soil moisture sensors? As well as the ET monitors, right? Back in the day, we weren't using moisture sensors as intensely as we are now. And you'd probably argue, wouldn't you, that we're much better waterers now because we're using those soil moisture sensors versus ET measurements?
You're right, yeah. So we actually did measure soil moisture every day within that trial. And I did. This was kind of right before the TDR craze kind of swept the turfgrass industry. I was actually doing this with a Troxler neutron gauge. So I actually had to certify this radioactive object or tool. It essentially is a great tool for measuring soil moisture. They actually use a lot in road construction because it does soil bulk density as well. But again, just before the TDR, you know, really came into place, and now we have the Pogo sticks, and so definitely, like you said, I mean, there's a lot of advances that we've made in the last few years as far as soil moisture technology.
So now I want to make the transition now to your PhD, because this is where I think when I look at your, you know, before we have a guest, I usually really review the sort of things you've worked on. And, you know, I want to have a conversation. You and I hardly know each other. We've had lunch over once at the MAGS meeting. I've sort of watched you work from afar, like I do with many of the guests. And I would say, you know, one of the things, and you said it there, you know, Poa annua doesn't like the stress it gets when it's overwatered, and it doesn't like it when it's underwatered. And we know that anthracnose is generally considered, in most cases, at least when you first get it, a generally weak pathogen that's taking advantage of a fairly weak plant. And so when I look at bacterial etiolation as it lends itself to the decline, right? Not the simple etiolation response, you know, where you get that, you know, you just mowed, you know, you just shaved and your hair's prickling out, or you just mow your greens and within a few hours you can see the etiolating shoots making their way back up. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the decline. How much of the whole bacterial decline thing, Joe, is related to, again, a sort of odd pathogenic problem, bacterial problem in this case, that's really taking advantage of stressed plants in some way, especially when it leads to a decline? What would you say if I wanted to connect your anthracnose work with stress on poa to your etiolation work with stress on bentgrass? Are they really similar strategies with plants at work there ecologically?
But with respect to the actual decline, I know you're really, you know, stressing the difference between etiolation and decline. And I would actually say that, you know, as far as bona fide pathogens and something that's really causing decline, I would say that Acinetobacter or any of the other bacteria that are identified with the decline of bentgrass or poa annua, they probably require more stress than even Colitostrum does in relation to anthracnose. We've seen so many, you know, any time when we're getting conditions where we're getting a significant decline in turf, it's really under intense environmental stress. Or equipment stress coupled with the presence of these particular bacteria.
Right. Okay. So here's my question then, Joe. I mean, to me, the question gets, you know, relatively simple. I mean, if are you saying there's no connection between what causes the etiolation versus what causes the decline? Because clearly, you know, what look like healthy surfaces get the etiolation response. And that's why I'm bringing the plant component into it, because, you know, when you've looked at biostimulants and you've looked at growth regulators, you know, you do see some minor associations along the way, unless you'd characterize them as major. I keep trying to think, you know, it's this weird interaction between something that's stressing the plant and that something that's allowing this organism to succeed. Did you really ever conclude it was related to a chemical or a growth regulator of any kind?
Well, I mean, just getting back to your original question, as far as the relationship between
etiolation
and
fine,
I definitely think that there is a relationship between the two. I mean, we have shown that the same bacteria that can cause etiolation can essentially result in decline. If you look at some of the work that I've done, as well as Paul Giordano, and now some future work that's coming out of Michigan State. So I definitely think that there's a relationship there. I think it's just that stress factor. You know, when we start to see these kinds of things pop up, you know, the etiolation, that rapid growth, it's typically during, you know, hey, we're getting a little bit of stress here. And then if you stay on it, you're staying on it with the low mowing heights, you know, the intense equipment traffic. I think that just kind of can push a plant over the edge when coupled with a bacterial infection like the Acetoborax or the Xanthomonas. So, you know, statistically, one of the things that I've always, you know, considered, I mean, we have not tested this yet, but I mean, what's one thing that's happened over the last decade? You know, mowing heights have continually gone down. And, you know, we get these etiolated plants, and what does an etiolated plant look like? It's kind of an elevated stem, you know, maybe some elevated meristematic tissue. And what do we know about anthracnose, especially with basal rot? Low mowing heights definitely impact the development of that disease, and that's because low mowing heights can damage the crown, and that's where you really see a lot of the interactions with increased anthracnose. And I think that's possibly the same case that we're seeing with etiolation. Continually low mowing plants or mowing plants, you know, frequently at a low mowing height, you know, especially with those elevated stems, maybe we're generating an environment that is more conducive to decline. So, you know, one of the first recommendations that we have as far as sites that have a bad etiolation problem is that, you know, examine your mowing heights. If you can just do an incremental increase in your mowing heights, that can reduce that potential for scalping. You know, there's definitely been some questions regarding growth regulators, and we've actually seen different responses with the same growth regulators with respect to the different bacteria that can actually cause this issue. So that's
more
confusing.
And it does, and that's why I'm almost in some ways don't really want to go down that path, because I'm not sure I would say there's anything conclusive there, because one of the things in telling in some of the papers, Joe, is that once you mowed the plots that were primo treated, for example, they had the highest turf quality. Now, so you know you've got what looks like, you know, dense turf there. We get the etiolation on higher cut turf and fairways. We might not get the decline in those cases, but, you know, again, you know, it's interesting because I know you talked in one paper fairly recently about the GA-producing microorganisms. And so if it is, in fact, some GA-producing microorganisms, you know, you look at the old work. And, of course, I don't know if you know this, but the original Xanthomonas work was done by a guy named Dave Roberts at Michigan State back with Joe Vargas on the C15 decline. I knew Dave when I worked at Michigan State. You knew that, right? Because you probably read those papers.
Yeah, I've actually emailed back and forth with him a few times. He's actually still working in extension in Michigan, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. He was working in Joe's diagnostic lab for a while. Anyway, so a lot of guys are saying, well, I got to spray streptomycin, or I got to spray dacaxurin, or I got to spray something on it. So let me transition to your next bit of work, because there obviously is something going on with these plants, right? There's something going on for sure with these bentgrass plants that's causing an environment for these microbial associations, let's call it that, to express itself. And it doesn't appear to be any clear-cut weather pattern or PGR effect, because, you know, while I was thrilled initially that when I saw the work years ago when Lane was there, Joe, we talked off air, when the biostimulant product treated plots had the worst etiolation and the non-treated plots didn't, I was hopeful that this might be an opportunity to get us to at least question the use of that. But if in fact, let's put products to the side for a second. Let's even put plant stress to the side for the second. What's the possibility that something that we're doing is altering the balance in the endophytic relationships that the plant has, root endophytes, shoot endophytes, rhizosphere, you know, communities of microbes? What's the possibility that we're doing something that's shooting that out of whack, and that is expressing itself through this phenomenon that we're calling etiolation and decline? So what do you think about that reaching statement there?
Well, it's certainly possible. I mean, and that's where we're kind of heading with some of the work that we're doing, is just understanding these individual, you know, plant microbe interactions, and then kind of understanding community interactions. And like you're saying, I mean, some of the work that's, you know, that they've shown with these GA producing bacteria, and when you're thinking about, you know, even small levels of GA, if you have a bacterium that's, you know, becoming more dominant in a population because of, you know, some sort of management interaction or even a chemical interaction that, you know, can produce small levels. And then, you know, a lot of these bacteria, they require a certain number of bacteria cells to actually show up in actual function. And so say we're, you know, we're altering that shift or balance in the community, and we all of a sudden have a bacterium that does have a capability of producing a hormone, and we're altering the balance to where that particular bacterium is becoming a little bit more populated. All of a sudden you start to get situations where you have conditions like these etiolated shoots that pop up because of, you know, the success of one particular organism that might be favored by a particular management interaction. So I definitely see where you're going there, and I think that that's a possibility, and that, you know, that definitely leads into some of the work that we're trying to initiate with these microbiome studies.
Great. So take a minute and introduce the audience to this national grant that you received to hold a meeting. Talk for a minute about how you've procured some funding to get this going as a national initiative, Joe.
Yeah, well, so, you know, we kind of following suit with the anthracnose project that I was a part of at Rutgers. You know, we had this Northeast Consortium or Northeast Regional Project that really brought together a lot of different university personnel and industry personnel looking at that particular issue of anthracnose and annual bluegrass weevil on annual bluegrass. And I'm sure you remember the NE 1025, and then I think it ended up turning into NE 1046.
So that's the project that project has morphed into the microbiome project.
Well, no, that I wouldn't say that project has morphed. That to my knowledge, that the anthracnose project has ended within the last year. And during that time, I decided that, you know, hey, it would be good for us to kind of come together as a turf industry and figure out how we're going to really research these interactions. Because there's a lot of different things at play here as far as developing research protocols and ways that we can share this information. Because you're looking at really massive amounts of data and there's a lot of different interactions.
Okay. So. All right. So we're going to do two things, you and me, Joe. The first thing we're going to do is you're going to give me in English what the hell you mean when you say microbiome.
All right. Well, you want a one sentence answer?
An answer that I can tell my wife and kids and say, oh, I understand what that is.
Well, the
They're
microbiome
reasonably intelligent people, but, you know, don't give me a geek answer, Joe.
Well, just playing back on the relationship. So I would say that the microbiome is basically the network of interactions between the microbes that surround the plant or live inside the plant, that thereby having a possible impact on the development of the particular plant. So we're looking at, you know, basically environmental snapshots of microorganisms, communities of organisms that live in and on the plant that we believe may be related to a function in turfgrass health.
Okay. So that sort of vibrant microbial community in the soil is servicing those grass plants.
That's the theory. So, I mean, look at how far we've come with gut microflora. You know, right. A lot of that has spawned from the studying of communities that live within the gut, and that's kind of led into the advance in probiotics and
that's right. Well, and in fecal transplants.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, we're in basically in the plant science world, they have, you know, there's a group of scientists that have come together and realized that, you know, we need to start doing these sort of things from a plant science standpoint. And that's really what spawned the phytobiome initiative with ATS. You have some, you know, some very prominent scientists that have come together and, you know, are basically working together to develop a lot of research in this area.
Right. All right. So listen, so I want to wrap it up here and get you out of here on this question. Well, first, the second question, and then I want to talk about Dan Donnelly's work. But before we get to that, when you say massive amounts of data, I want to make sure to people who are listening, I want to first make sure I understand it and then make sure people who are listening to this understand it as well. When you say enormous amounts of data, it's because we're basically taking that soil microbial community, exposing it to, well, you're doing two things. One, if you want to test function, there's methodologies for determining nutrient cycling and organic matter degradation because we have some idea of functionality of these microbial communities, and we have ways of putting them in contact with a substrate that then lets us see their activity in the soil, right? That's one way of getting data, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, essentially a lot of the work that we have going on right now, especially within the turf world, is more, I would call, census data. So we're really just trying to get an idea of what's out there.
Okay, so you're chomping up RNA, you're chomping up DNA and running it through sort of essentially fingerprinting tools that allows you quantitatively to determine the genomes there and identify it from some database?
Yeah, exactly. So we're, you know, kind of similar to the way that, you know, we identify plant pathogens, you know, on the BLAST database that's locally available. What we're doing with the microbiome work is we're actually looking at communities or millions of those individual sequences and seeing how many different, you know, organisms or different microbes to a certain microbial group, whether it be bacteria, fungi, archaea. Okay. So trying to look at all of these different organisms in together to provide an environmental snapshot of what's, you know, what organisms are there with a specific condition, you know, and we can relate this to the species that are there, the environmental conditions that are there, or even in future nutrient disease interactions.
Right, right. Okay, good. So there's two components to sort of peeling this onion apart. One is who are the players, and the second is what are they doing? And then it's the context that Dan Donnelly brings in that we had on our last podcast, Joe, that you said you listened to. And, you know, Dan is my mad scientist superintendent friend in Chicago at North Shore Country Club that's currently growing some sophisticated root zone mix, primarily sand with biochar and Miramichi stuff and vermicompost in it. And then his other unique component, Joe, is he's growing varieties of bentgrass on it because of the perception, or at least the understanding, that all of these plant soil systems is this complex feedback system between the microbiome or the microbes in the soil and the plants and the exudates and the organic matters that they create. And his idea is if he enriches that root zone from the get-go with plants that are going to sustain it, it will keep organic matter accumulation by the plant at bay. And by finding a way to recycle that sand and root zone and not simply applying straight sand to the surface, will we prevent this chasing of the tail as we were talking about it in the podcast where you put on straight sand and then you get more organic matter, so you got to put on more sand and that gives you more organic matter, so you got to put on more sand and that gives you more organic matter. And so that's the sort of chasing the tail thing that we've been discussing. So, you know, in context, that's my sense of what Dan's doing. Let me know your thoughts on this idea. conceptually anyway.
Literally, they're, like I said, you know, they're microbiomes of everything. We've learned a lot with gut microflora and understanding the relationships to human health. There are even microbiomes that exist in concrete. And I've actually seen a presentation on this. So, you know, understanding how these relationships exist is definitely integral. And I understand exactly, you know, what you're saying with the work that Dan's doing by examining all of these different factors in conjunction. So basically, that's one of the things that we've seen with some of the microbiome work that we've done, or the initial work, is how much different factors, individual factors, can play a role on the microbiome of the plant. And you know, one of the things that's really interesting about this work is that there are different microbiomes on different parts of the plant. And I have a student that's actually been working in this area for the last year, and he's been sampling plants above ground and below ground, and they're entirely different populations.
Right.
So, you know, understanding how, you know, different things are going to interact with this, like you're saying, with organic matter production. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we've always known that, you know, decomposition of organic matter is, you know, microbes are involved in that decomposition, and as well as nutrients.
But they're not good at it. They're not good at it in northern climates, Joe. I mean, this is what he was talking about, too, is, you know, we've created a situation. Essentially, it's just this pile of lignin. And we don't have a microbial community in a straight sand environment that is going to, you know, is going to do like ligase does, right? And mm-hmm. And what Kaminsky says is happening in thatch collapse, right? Where you have this organism that's producing ligase, this artillery fungus that's rapidly breaking down lignin, is literally a community you would say, right? We'd like to encourage some of in the soil system, isn't it? In our turf systems, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and that's what we're really trying to get to in some of the beginning work, is where we can send, you know, basically sample different populations over different environments and look at individual functions and kind of correlate it with things that we're seeing, in hopes that we can develop application years down the road to where we can introduce a certain individual microbe or group of microbes that essentially contributes to those benefits that we really want. I mean, there's a lot of factors at play here, but you know, that is one of the overall goals and how
and
we're
I wonder,
this microbiome
and
research.
Yeah, this is perfect. And so two things now. One is, you said years from now, you know, no baloney. My sense is I would be surprised if we got there in less than 7 to 10 years where our understanding of this was operational. And I don't view it that we might incorporate microbes, Joe. I'm looking at it like we have to understand what sort of a functional collection or a functional microbiome in turf systems are. And that's going to be a tricky question in and of itself because, for example, you have a lot of systems that we'd like them to be drier. Right. If we could make them drier or in drought areas, you might want a functional community that enhances drought stress tolerance. Right. But in the Northeast, I might want a different palate. So I'm wondering if, as opposed to inoculants, that we would find a way to plant and manage the system so that it encouraged that sort of that functional operation and that. For example, what if coring in the fall is the worst thing to do for ligase-producing microorganisms?
Yeah, that would be an interesting thing to look at. I mean, it
right?
makes perfect sense. And I completely agree with what you're saying. I mean, it's not going to be so much just inoculants. It's definitely community. So it's going to be coming into looking at nutrient management. I mean, one of the things that we're particularly interested in is some of these amendments that are going into root zones. So whether it be a compost amendment or these biochars, I mean, what is biochar? It's a carbon source. What do microbes feed off of? Carbon.
So, and then if you get into that, you open up. And once you go down the wormhole of biochars, you know, what's the feedstock of the biochar?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly. And these are definitely regional.
That's right. It's and to be honest, Joe, wouldn't you say, to really be sustainable, we'd want to have your source for whatever biochar you were produce or using came locally. I mean, one of the problems with sand top dressing is the hauling of the sand, right?
Yes.
And the footprint of hauling the sand is, and if it's doing nothing but causing us to chase our tail, that creates an interesting discussion in and of itself. So is my time frame pretty good? Do you think 7 to 10? Because you're right now going about it the right way. I think you're doing a census. So is the census telling us anything yet? Or do you think – how long until you think we got some understanding of the players here?
Well, some of the work that we've done initially, we have a really kind of a multi-year project going on actually with the mall reconstruction down in Washington, D.C. And this is kind of an interesting environment to do some of this work because of the way that site is now constructed with these modified root zones. And it's really an interesting way to go about this. It's kind of an introductory census of microbial communities. And one of the and that's a key point here is like really need to start this from the beginning with an idea of just understanding what's out there and just how general turf production impacts a soil microbial community.
Right.
One of the questions that we have with this particular area is just how the changes in environment, with this sod being brought in from a sod farm that's within the region, but it is definitely changing environment. So we're looking at how that change in environment can impact these communities living on and in the leaves. And we've actually shown that the simple change of environment can actually alter the microbial community structure within a short time frame. So that's just one, example that we're seeing. And then, like I mentioned, some of the work that my graduate student's doing with looking at, the comparing of the root microbes and the foliar microbes and how different they are. But getting back to some of these, development of these standard research protocols, essentially trying to, that's one of the overall goals of this Northeast project. I have myself here at Maryland. We've got Bruce Clark and Jim Murphy from Rutgers, Michelle DaCosta at UMass, Johnny Guajardo at UConn, number of different players, even people outside the region.
Is Jenny from Cornell involved?
She is definitely involved. So, she's done some very interesting work looking at these communities. And that's, again, the whole point of bringing everyone together is so that we can really, pick the key areas that we need to identify first and sort of divide them amongst the, the minds in the room and pick apart our key areas. And then that's how we get to those applications faster, by bringing together the scientists that can tackle those specific areas and then hopefully – get some idea of functional qualities of a certain microbial community and then eventually lead to certain applications in the field that are related to these beneficial microbes.
And there you go. Professor Joe Roberts in the Department of Plant Science and Landscape Architecture at the University of Maryland. Joe, that was a perfect way to end this episode. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule. And how are you liking Maryland so far? It's a little bit north of where you were raised and a little bit south of Rutgers. It
could be a
perfect spot.
It's right in the middle. Yeah, it's right in the middle of North Carolina and New Jersey. So, and it's funny because, being here in the transition zone, I've seen more warm seasons creeping north into Maryland. And I definitely have a lot of warm season experience and cool seasons. So we grow pretty much all turfgrass species here in Maryland. So it's no shortage of plant pathogens and microbial communities to study.
Yeah, it is. I always say, and I've had my pal, and you guys are lucky to have Steve McDonald as a real wonderful professional resource in the Mid-Atlantic area. I always think that's the toughest place to grow grass. If you put a band around Washington, D.C., Baltimore, down in Maryland, cutting over to St. Louis, to me, that's the front lines of turf management in an age of climate change, because that line keeps moving every year one way or the other, creeping up for the warm season grasses for sure. So I hope everybody's treating you good in that Mid-Atlantic area. It certainly is a tricky place to be, and you've got the right agronomic background, and I know Pete was a pathologist at heart, Peter Noden. So I'm sure you're getting plenty of work with your pathology skills in that area too, huh, Joe?
Oh, yes, certainly. Yeah, and there's definitely a great industry here. I've been very fortunate to have some great people to work with in my short time here, and I'm definitely looking forward to the years to come. So,
great. Joe Roberts in the Department of Plant Science and Landscape Architecture, University of Maryland. I'm Frank Rossi at Cornell University and the TurfNet Radio Network. This is Frankly Speaking, smart talk from leading thinkers.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in.